When you score more disallowed goals than real ones, it's That's So MLS, a North American soccer podcast with myself, Andrew Bates, and Nick Thornton.
Hello.
Nick, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. You know, as much as it's been kind of a marathon, now that we're getting down to the nitty-gritty end of it, I'm feeling a little sad, you know?
It's true. So much has happened this year, and we find ourselves once again at the brink of an MLS Cup final.
This has just been a gangbusters year for MLS, too. Like, we've really had everything and several kitchen sinks in this season in terms of player moves, coaching moves, teams up and down, goals galore. It's been pretty stellar. It's kind of weird to be here and thinking about in just a few short days, it's all going to be over.
Remember the time this year that, like, they just announced a club was happening? Like, by kind of, like, not, they did a press conference, but it was just like, you woke up one morning and they were like, hey, so Cincinnati is playing next year.
Yeah.
Anyways, happy Wednesday.
Yeah, move along. How about Atlanta United? And it turns out they were right.
We've reached our final two. I was thinking about it in about what the two clubs represent. And if you want to be florid, which I absolutely do, it's not like they themselves are sort of two different polar opposites, but I would say that the four semifinal teams represent four different kind of MLS teams, in a sense.
Absolutely.
Like, you have in Atlanta, you have sort of an expansion team that was sprung from nothing. In Portland, you have the expansion team that claims a deeper tradition. In New York and Sporting Kansas City, you had MLS originals, but New York is the sort of the reclaimed, refinanced version.
Mm-hmm.
And Sporting Kansas City is the one that has always sort of tried to keep pace with the various changes.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very true. And I think that's good context kind of leading into things and three different styles of play. Absolutely. Four different. I can count. Only three teams played in this. Well, to some degree, that's kind of true.
Yeah. Do you want to start? You know, I feel like the logical starting point is Atlanta, New York. New York only managed to get one goal that counted at the very, very end of the tie in injury time. Unfortunate, because this is the sort of, like, you know, we'd always said that New York could find ways to beat Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And it is kind of sad that they showed they had the ability to do that long after it mattered.
Yeah, and outside of, Martinez almost scoring in the opening seconds of the game, New York really turned on the Jets, and for, I think, around 15, almost 20 minutes looked like the team that could perhaps find a way. But it became very clear, especially in the second half, that Atlanta had a game plan that involved possibly not scoring any goals. And just
Which is not something you expect out of them.
No, but we can't expect to see them just play an incredibly frustrating, tight game in midfield. And it wasn't that they had a complete lack of chances or weren't moving forward. But this idea where we've seen them give up goals in the past is where they're throwing everything forward and they're just overwhelming their opponents. This was really more of a measured pace of, like, all right, guys, like, if it's on and there's a chance, take it. But otherwise, we are here to defend, 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 break up play in the middle of the park. New York Red Bulls work best when they've got possession and they have a lot of build-up play, and Atlanta just came in and broke up play and made it very, very frustrating for New York Red Bulls.
Is there a more apt phrase to describe Atlanta's game than frustrating for opponents?
Regardless of what style of play they play?
Yeah. It's like attacking or not. It's like one thing that they are very good at. Whatever it is, They know how to make people mad.
It became very apparent in that second half there was just no way in for New York Red Bulls, and Tata had really figured them out. They had 45 minutes, I think, to do something. Had they gotten a goal or two in that first half, who knows? They were certainly giving everything, but I still think, you know, Atlanta and Tata Martino were smart enough to know that they were going to do that, and so really dug down, concentrated, did the basics. So although they were out of possession a lot and looked like they were sort of bending at times, I think they were actually in control of a lot of that first half.
It's frustrating because I feel like a lot of, in a sense, especially that first attempt from Martinez, is something that I very much think of as, like, and I think I said, you know, you could have, the possibility to beat Portland for New York is, the possibility to beat Atlanta in Atlanta is to come out really strong, really fast. And New York did not do that in the home leg. And it's almost funny that, like, Atlanta is just like, here's what you should have done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With that very early chance.
Absolutely. And that highlights it as well and shows the versatility and creativity and belief in this team. I mean, not that Martinez needs any extra belief in himself. But I think that that was part of the game plan as well. Of like, look, we're going to frustrate the hell out of them for much of the game, but we know they're going to come out at us flying. But if we score in the first half, it's done. It's utterly finished. I mean, it was kind of finished anyway before it started, but there was just never a way that the Red Bulls were going to score four goals to take it to extra time. And so
it's so rough because it's like, we all got to go here and do a soccer game.
Yeah. And we talked about it last week, is even just the attitude and kind of press conferences going into it. They're kind of like, yeah, this is kind of an impossible task, but not a lot of like, and therefore our plan is X. Not that you'd expect them to reveal a ton of tactics. Again, 45 minutes, I thought they played really well, and at points looked like, oh, maybe like if they can get a goal in the first half, maybe a second one early on in the second half, and they get the momentum going and they get the fans behind them, it could happen. And I think the frustrating thing, I'm sure, for Red Bulls fans, and I've seen a little bit of the reaction, is, yes, had the Red Bulls played like this in Atlanta and then played similarly at home, it might actually be a different story. But they really did lose it in the first leg, and it was just far too little too late. And to, you know, to bank on a 98th minute side-footed ball from Tim Parker as your only goal over the tie is like, well, that for me summed it up of like, where are your star players when it mattered? Where were the performances individually and collectively? And okay, a little glimmer of hope, but far too little too late.
Well, let's get into the one thing in terms of the one goal. In this game, we also see a disallowed goal as we did in the first.
Yes.
I think it's pretty clear if you look at the replays that Aaron Long never touched the ball with his head.
Yeah.
Which would obviously make it not a goal. But, you know, I've heard the sentiment that if that first allowed goal, you know, what would have been scenario in the case of if that first goal stands, then it's 1-1, and then things might be different. I wonder, do you think that even though the long goal should not have stood, you, to a certain degree, look at a series that where the ball went into the goal three times on each side, and do you think that there is any grounds for being grumpy about that, or is it just, you know, poor luck?
In this game, I feel like it was poor luck. I mean, like, we talked about setting precedents, and like, the precedent should be set that you make the right call, and I think both were the right call. Absolutely, it would change the game, but that's kind of like, if they just scored a goal that properly, then they wouldn't be in this mess. And like, where's Kaku? Where's BWP? Like, where are the performances? Where's Royer to step up and unequivocally sink a ball? If you're relying on these iffy scenarios, I think just as a fan, I'm willing to say if that's my team, I go, no, like, actually put the ball in the back of the net, score an allowable goal. You can't be too upset. Like, there's rules for a reason. It sucks when things go against you. They probably should have gotten more out of the Atlanta game, but again, you knew that going in.
I feel like Atlanta was able to create this intimidating aura about them where having a disallowed goal really did have a negative emotional impact where, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to. You could think, guys, we're so close, let's keep pushing.
Yeah.
But I wonder if there's this attitude that it was so hard to even get there and we couldn't score a goal, and sort of like a release of tension, a disappointed release of tension.
Absolutely. I think that for as well as they've played, I still don't think you can really say that this is a team that believed in themselves to get the job done. And that was on full display, that they never really looked like a team that could run away and win it. They looked like a team for 45 minutes that could make it interesting. Mm-hmm. But I don't really, I think, like, obviously the best teams make their own luck, and also they get a lot of luck from referees. But you take away penalty shouts and disallowed goals for Atlanta this season, and you still have a team that's very capable of winning MLS Cup and beating New York Red Bulls. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. But again, if you know that going in, that should also be part of your plan.
Let me hit you with one more.
One more what?
let me hit you with one more what if, right? If New York Red Bull starts the series at home, do they still lose?
Yeah. Yes. I think so.
Okay.
I think they do. Probably not as quickly. Probably not as unequivocally. But I think we saw kind of a similar thing with Columbus, right? It's like you can get out in front of them at home. Maybe you can win it. Maybe you get a draw. But when you go to Mercedes-Benz, you've got 75,000 people jeering you, and then a team that's just completely buoyed by that and is going to come and completely flatten you. Mm-hmm. So I think it would have been a similar result. In fact, I could see it happen. I could see the exact same result happening as New York Red Bulls win 1-0 at home, and then Atlanta wins 3-0, like in their house. So
I guess
the away goals don't count as much, but like that's how I think it would have played out.
Where does this leave New York? Because they had they sort of were the drafting the stalking horse pick in the final weeks of the season. They have this record breaking season, and then they can't. Get past a team that they beat pretty handily more than once in the regular season. Where do they go? What's the change you would make in the offseason for them?
That's a great question. One I don't necessarily feel fully equipped to answer because they just did so many things right. I think a lot of things for teams is being able to keep a coach for the whole season matters. I mean, obviously this is a bit of an anomaly, and I thought the changeover ultimately was pretty smooth. But doubtlessly, I think kind of had people asking questions. One of the most poorly kept secrets in MLS is that Tyler Adams was going to be leaving imminently. So you also have a young star player that you kind of know is on his way out. I think it's so hard to say because they've had so many fantastic players, especially in their midfield, who have that extra sort of creative spark. I do think getting rid of both Felipe and Clushton were mistakes. And I think the players they replaced them with have at times arisen to the occasion, but at times really haven't. This season, they were able to get past BWP's frustration of relying on BWP to score all their goals, and they scored more goals by committee. However, it hasn't quite been good enough, has it? But outside of that, I'm not really sure. I don't know. What do you think they need to change?
it's tough because you could kind of, in a sense, say, you know, the well, you did your best. You came up across, you came up against a just another team that was also really strong. But that approach to the first half really does seem like the wrong choice. And I'm not saying that Chris Armas is a terrible coach or anything.
He's a great
successfully,
coach.
He successfully navigated that team in a really tough, you know, circumstance in the regular season. He took over mid-season, which is not easy at all. But the fact, you know, Marsh going to Leipzig as a assistant manager that's the manager that started the year for the Red Bulls. Adams going to Leipzig. It's in an era where there are more connected clubs.
Mm-hmm.
You wonder what is going to be the mentality towards putting resources towards New York.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Adams was leaving. I mean, like, if it wasn't to Leipzig, it was going to be somewhere else. But what they have now is good. The system they have in place is good. Maybe this was just a learning opportunity for Armas, and maybe we'll see more and better next year. The squad is basically all together. They released their options. They didn't release anyone that I really thought was key to what they had done. Tim Parker is out of contract. Your hero in mind, the playoff goal hero in that series.
But they are negotiating with him. So
they're negotiating with him. They would like to bring him back.
I think
obviously it would be nice to see him stay in the league or go to wherever he wants to go. But
one of the things that I thought must have been really frustrating for Red Bulls fans, and I was kind of tweeting about this as a remorseful off-season Whitecap fan, is just how good Parker's been there and just how good the New York Red Bulls back line has been. That does show you, granted it didn't necessarily work against Atlanta, but proper investment in that really does make a difference. And
yes,
all four teams that have reached the semifinals have invested a significant amount of time and money in their back lines. And these aren't second pick, kind of cobbled together, let's hope it works defenses. These are carefully considered, carefully scouted, and paid what they're worth defenses. And that shows. So I think New York doesn't have a ton to do there. The one thing I would say that would maybe be on my shopping list is a little bit more speed on the team. They do like to play in possession, but their counterattacks can sometimes be a little neutered. And when Atlanta switched into high gear, they really struggled to keep up with just the pace of passing that happened. I don't think it's like a major deficit of theirs, but I think having a couple of quicker wingers out to break out and provide more of a counter-attacking option could be really helpful when you've got some really clinical finishers in front and some skilled midfielders to create chances. But yeah, otherwise I agree. I don't think this is a team that needs to rebuild by any stretch. And essentially with their roster moves today, it seems like they're kind of trimming the fat. And they're bringing back everything that was successful and adding to it. You have to imagine that's going to be a pretty talented team.
I think the one thing that we don't talk about, maybe because of the energy drink logo that's on their shirt, is how little they spend in salaries. I'm just double checking the teams to make sure that this information is actually accurate. But they are like fifth from the bottom in terms of spending this year.
Yeah, I think we talked about that maybe briefly. I can't remember if it was on air or not, but when they were when that whole sort of table was released, we were quite surprised at how low they spent, but they've certainly spent wisely.
That is true. And it's like, I guess maybe it just speaks to, you know, you're right that they've done better as a committee. But Bradley Wright Phillips is one of the league's top stars. And I don't know, I have to double check what he's getting paid in terms of, you know, whether or not he he's 25th. He's getting paid, you know, $1.6 million, which is a deal.
Yeah.
In MLS in terms of a lead striker. Do we want to move to the second game?
Let's do.
There was a lot of a lot more fireworks in this one, possibly because the tie was still alive. Oops, oops, oops.
It does help if you've given yourself a chance to win the game.
Yeah, right. Portland 3, Sporting Kansas City 2, both in the second leg and on aggregate. It's interesting to see the way that Portland have, once again, everybody remembers the 2015, everybody remembers the 2015 run, that where they, you know, were so well acclaimed, for being these scrappers that made it in at the very last moment, it made it all the way to MLS Cup. They just kept finding ways to get in front.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because when we were talking about, you know, last week, who's the team more likely to win? We said mm-hmm. Portland. And when we asked who's the team more likely to beat Atlanta, we said Sporting Kansas City. And now after watching that game, I'm kind of like, well, maybe Portland is just crazy enough to make this work. Like, if we thought, like, if there's a way to unlock Atlanta, what's it going to take? It's going to take moments of brilliant individual skill. It's going to take moments of great collective defense. But it's also going to take some risky play. And it means
Jeffrey Adnella is going to have a long, dark night of the soul.
Yeah. And they're going to give up goals. You have to be okay with giving up goals so long as you're able to retaliate. Before we think about the final and that likelihood, what overall is just your assessment of this game? I mean, we both sort of picked Portland as the favorites to come in and somehow make something happen, even at the fortress that is Children's Mercy Park. Were you surprised? What were your takeaways from this whole thing?
I think that the story of this game and certainly other games, the playoffs as well, is defenses allowing players to drift in on the outside or outside of pressure, or just like, I don't know whether or not it's strategy or whatever, but just demarcating like, this is the area we're worried about.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we're going to put our attention. And this was the first goal with Daniel Shalloway sort of drifting in on the far side to get that first goal. And the second goal, which came in on the 52nd minute, I think is going to be Portland's lifeline. Was Portland's lifeline here in Seattle is the equalizing goal by Sebastian Blanco. Or just the tide-turning goal, where he is allowed to come at, like he's given the ball practically on the touchline, and he is able to walk it in to a really dangerous zone, kind of without being pressured, because nobody wants to step up and challenge him because they think he's going to pass.
Well, and as much as
beautiful, beautiful 20-yard shot.
Yeah, as much as that goal was a little bit of black magic, it was also basically a free kick because there's no pressure on him. And as you say, he's allowed to just walk up and place the ball exactly where he wants. Part of me was like, oh, shoot, did he use up all his black magic there? And can he conjure up the same thing at Atlanta? But it's that kind of awareness. And people say it's belief, and I think certainly that helps. But just the awareness that's a shot is we see a lot of MLS teams kind of squander those opportunities. And, you know, if there's a way to beat Atlanta or at least get a goal against them, it's to catch them a little off guard. And Sebastian Blanco had the wherewithal to see around him, to know he wasn't being pressured, to see the open passes as well, but just to crack it and do what he did. And I would say that, like, every goal that Portland scored was such a cleverly devised goal. And that is what makes me think, okay, maybe there's a way. And it's not much of a way. I don't think it's super likely to go to Mercedes-Benz and get a result and to win the cup. But, I mean, you'd score even one of those beautiful goals and then an ugly one. And Atlanta scores two. Atlanta's a team you can beat in extra time or penalties.
I think that that's absolutely true. I think that the something that I felt that in terms of a shutdown attack, the Red Bulls were not able to tackle Atlanta because they tried to play this super aggressive attacking style or defend. They tried to really gum up things and play sort of away from their type.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't. If you're going to play a containment style, you have to contain the other team. And if you don't do it, it's just not going to. They're going to find the crack in your armor over and over again.
Yeah.
Portland have this wonderful Western Conference counterattacking style where they don't need the ball. They had 40% of possession in this game. The shots were 20-8, but only 8 of those 20 shot attempts from Sporting Kansas City were shots on target. That is an interesting recipe for me because if you are committing everything back and playing a much more defensively focused game and in trying to play that shutdown style that Atlanta played in the second half, you're not creating a lot of opportunities for yourself. Whereas if you have this counterpunching style, I think that that is something that maybe can work against Atlanta.
Absolutely. And I mean, it will take absolutely everything from this team, but I'm not going to write them off and say they don't have a chance. There's that side of it. Sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to sort of shift focus to Sporting Kansas City here because as fantastically well as Portland played, I think, you know, there were still two teams that played and SKC scored two goals. So I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on how do you rank Sporting Kansas City's performance on this game and similarly for, as you said, with New York, is like what needs to change there for Peter Vermees because they've had a hell of a season.
They had a lot of great chances, and they have relied on. They had a great season in their attacking players. Chalouid, Jurso, came in for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like they did score goals. They scored two goals. I think that the not being able to get anything away hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Something about the more complete style teams, and by that I mean a team that is not necessarily attacking weighted, and I wouldn't say that Sporting Kansas City is really defensive weighted these days as they were last year,
mm-hmm.
as much as they were last year. Like one of the teams that tries to have this balance between attack and defense really needs those players to link up. And I don't think that by any means that this was a failing of, you know, a player like Johnny Russell, but you know, when you look at that shot chart, what it tells you is they needed more to go in. And not just that, they needed to get the momentum. Something about the way that they scored that first goal did not commute to them a feeling of momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Portland had Portland did not have the best first half at all. And you look at I mean, tell you this, right? I didn't really when it was live, I didn't watch the second half.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a holiday party, so I was like, I caught the very, very end of the game in injury time. Or no, I caught like a very short amount of time with no words. And I thought that Sporting Kansas, for whatever reason, I thought Sporting Kansas City had scored 2-0, and then Portland came back to win, because that's how dominant they had been earlier in that game.
Mm.
And you really feel like maybe they should have had 2 goals in that first half.
Yeah, and as much as the questions, of course, then the question then becomes, well, did they, you know, is it the lack of a star striker that makes it this way? And I'd say, look, they made it this far without a star striker, and that's pretty good. And mm-hmm. that really well-balanced team and really well-coached team can have a great impact. But it's no secret the thing that they've struggled with the most this season is that even with the shift in focus from not just being about defending, is they haven't really been able to finish in the final third. And they had more chances on this night. And Portland got their chances because Kansas had to play a little bit differently, and they knew they had to go and play more aggressively, which left them more open. I think it's, although nobody's putting pressure on Blanco, I wouldn't necessarily call it a defending mistake. I think you can forgive not expecting a player to take that kind of ball. Maybe putting more pressure on them so that they don't have the option is good. But both goals, I mean, the second goal from Valeri is just tired legs, and you know you're out, because at that point, Portland was winning on aggregate anyway.
Yeah.
But that first goal is just the classic, the defenders looking around, they want the offside call, and by the time they realize that Valeri is steaming in for that second ball that the goalkeeper's not able to correctly deal with, he's got it. He's up for the header, and he's going to knock it home. So there was a couple of mistakes there, but overall I think Sporting Kansas City's biggest mistake was just that their finishing has not been great this season. It's been better, but I think that's the homework for Peter Vermees now is I need a striker, and I need a backup striker who can consistently sink 13, 14 plus goals a year. And that's not something they've had in a while. And they need somebody a little bit more clinical up at the top of the box, because God knows they can cut through your midfield. They can run down the wings. They can get the ball into the right position. It's that tricky, pesky business of getting it into the back of the net that they struggled with.
And you were talking earlier about belief in the team, and this is something that the commentators hammered on with a second goal from Portland. What to me marks it is as being something that comes from, you know, belief and a team performance and momentum, as well as, like, you know, shows how good Diego Valeri's game is that Valeri has launched himself over the defenders to head a rebound that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Like all Valeri is doing is like thinking on it. We're going forward. We're going to make an attempt. I've got to be like in the air in that general zone.
Yeah.
Like he can't start the movement that he makes to score that goal after the rebound happens. He just puts himself into that position on like a hunch.
But I forget the player that kind of chips it at first at the goalkeeper. The player that starts that play.
There was no assist. That player does not win an assist off of that play.
So no.
He just...
But looking... Was it Asprilla? No. Anyway, while you look that up, yeah. I'll make the comment. Lackey.
Ebobasi.
I kind of think that play might have been a little bit intentional. Is like, hit an awkward ball at the goalkeeper and force him to make a decision. But Ebobasi looks over and does see Valeri running in. I think he's the only player in that final third that saw Valeri running in. So I'm not going to say it was perfectly executed or that he wasn't trying to take his own shot, but part of me thinks that that play, part of it was by design. Certainly Ebobasi sees Valeri, but I agree. The amount of work that he has to do on just the hope that if he's there, he'll be able to launch himself and get a rebound that hasn't happened yet. To me, maybe we're not giving them enough credit to be like, I think that might have been a play they drew up, is on a counterattack, if you can draw Tim Melia out, if he can catch him a little bit off guard, mix him up with his defenders, and get a rebound, that's going to be your chance. Because that first time save, you know Melia's probably going to get there.
It's smart to plan for those rebounds as well.
And really good teams do. Like, that's something that I think people forget sometimes, is having played on teams where there's a goalkeeper spills it at an amateur level a lot. There's a lot of second chances. But not often is somebody there to clean it up and put it away.
This I believe this directly leads into one of my favorite coach fan interactions of all time.
Oh yeah.
Where somebody is throwing cans, and I couldn't tell from the broadcast whether or not the Budweiser can was full or empty. Maybe it was full, and that's what created such an issue.
It was half full, just like Sporting Kansas Dreams.
An object is thrown, and the referee makes the decision, which is strange because I feel like things have been thrown on the pitch before in games, to pull the players off the field.
I think it was, there was quite a bit, and it was raining down on Antonella, and like, I don't think he was hit by anything necessarily, but there was quite a bit of garbage coming onto the field that, like, some players had kicked off some. Now, it wasn't a ton, but I think it was also just the fever pitch of the crowd. When you saw some of the close-ups, like, there was a lot of people really into it, and I think the vast majority were just yelling and screaming and screaming at the referee and trying to get behind their team. I agree, it didn't seem like there was really enough of a threat necessarily to pull the players off the field. I think, though, part of that might have been a decision by someone else, but I'll let you finish your favorite part of the match before I explain what I think.
Peter Vermees, the manager of Sporting Kansas City, takes this moment to walk onto the pitch. He's like, I will handle this. In his pea coat, he walks pretty much like 15 feet up to 15 feet away from the cauldron, which is the supporters section stand in Kansas City, yells at them about this with his hands out like, guys, don't be idiots. And everybody that he's looking at says, it was those guys over there. And point to the, the stage left.
Yeah.
From where they are looking. And Vermees stalks across the whole penalty area yelling at people. I don't know what he's saying, but I imagine, like, was it you? Was it you?
Look.
Who threw that?
I'll give you this. Can you think of anything more terrifying as a fan if you've had a couple of beers and all of a sudden you've got Peter Vermees screaming at you from 15 feet away?
And he's looking at people in the eye.
Yeah, I know. That's true. That's the thing that makes this so different. This is not a coach just like making some show of going over to the fans to be like, okay, guys, cut it out. But like, keep throwing stuff if you need to. He was like incensed. My favorite part of this happens before, and
yes,
is where he does go over to the referee after the referee's just told everyone to come off the pitch. And he actually asks for permission. But it's basically like a, do you want me to go talk to these guys? And the referee's just like, yeah, I guess so. And clearly hadn't ever been asked that question before. At which point, and he does it quite calmly, and then he just like marches over. I mean, he covered as much ground as Diego Valeri did in that moment. And with the same pace, like he just stomps over with such purpose and intent. It's like, you will not throw things on my field.
I want someone to write a crowd psychology thesis about this. Like,
oh,
like about him.
My friend has.
Already?
I'll try to get it to you. I'll send it to you. Yes. Sociologist friend of mine, Niels, did his PhD on crowd behavior in soccer stadiums and like mass hysteria and stuff.
So I love this idea that this one guy could be like, because it is kind of like, can I go to, I'm just going to go, you know, you tell the bouncer, like, I'm going to go talk to my friends and tell them to chill out, okay? Except that it's one person out of about 600 friends,
mm-hmm,
or however many people fit in that end. And it's like, I remember seeing shots from earlier in the game too, where some parts on that Kansas City touchline behind the goal, you are having people that are really kind of just stacked, like standing behind the advertising hoardings three deep. One of them, I love the guy that is legitimately legitimately cooking barbecue, like had a Sporting Kansas City apron and on. He's just, and some
turns around like, oh. wouldn't be MLS if there wasn't some shenanigans, but that was definitely, I've seen coaches plead with fans before, but I've never seen just such a stern dad move. That, like, he didn't necessarily yell. He was just like, I'm not angry. I'm disappointed.
If you don't tell me who threw the can, you're all grounded.
Like, just him marching over to the stands at home. At home, I felt guilty. I was like, oh no. Oh God. Oh, he's angry.
Oh my God.
Dad's not happy.
Dad's not happy. And in Sporting Kansas City, for all the sort of grief we're giving them, we're able to establish something late on, right? It's not like they were hopeless. They made things interesting throughout the last 10 minutes with that goal from Gerso.
Yeah. Absolutely. It was a great bit of work. Corner set piece and corner kick combined is a corner piece.
Drifting up to the pack in the penalty area.
They flood the box. The Portland defenders don't even see him. There's no one marking him, and he's able to knock it in. That's the thing for me. If Portland is going to have any hope against Atlanta, they've got to be reviewing that tape and looking very closely at those things, because marking on set plays is going to be a big thing that's important, and not letting players drift in. Otherwise, I thought it was the first goal, I think, is not great, but can see how it happens. But they've got to be watching their man marking on set pieces and when you've got players out wide.
Martinez will tear you apart if you just let him or Almiron wander into that zone.
Incredible to me. I mean, I think people figured out with Almiron, he's not usually afforded much space, which is why he wins so many fouls. But it's incredible to me the amount of space Martinez is allowed. And part of it is because he's brilliant and can create the space. But how many games have you seen this season where it's a set piece or, you know, it's a counterattack and everybody's crowding around Almiron and Martinez is just standing there between the two center backs who are looking forward and he's just like, go on, just hit it. It's fine. And then splits them and runs and crushes it in. You're like, basically, you should have your arms around his neck at all times.
Yeah, no doubt. With Sporting Kansas City, you know, now is the eulogy moment for them where we say last year they were this team that had a legendary attacking ability a defensive ability to not let goals in, but they were unable to put goals in, like, as we said, you know, in their opponent's goal. But this year they scored 25 more goals. So they scored 40 goals in the regular season. They scored 65 this year while only allowing 11 more. Which is an interesting outlook. They were able to sort of make the additions and make the changes necessary to add that dimension to their game, but that wasn't enough to really make them super dominant throughout the course of the regular season. I mean, I guess they were near the top of that standings the whole time, but they weren't. They only rarely and on rare occasions looked like they were in the same sort of ballpark as New York and Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's fair to say. But as we've said before, we'll say again, if you want to make it this late into the stages, you have four teams that defensively were very, very good at points this season. Well, not just at points, but consistently pretty strong. Portland obviously had their moments. But ultimately, again, four teams that really, really put a lot of time, effort, and in some cases money behind these back lines that I think... we may see a balance of power shift in the next couple of years in MLS with just so many teams that teams are now beginning to, the top teams anyway, I think, understand that a little bit. Is sure, you can pay your DPs as much as you want and have this incredible attacking presence, but Atlanta's not gotten there by the number of goals Martinez has scored or the number of goals Almiron has set up or scored off of free kicks. They've gotten there because they're tight at the back and they have a great goalkeeper. You know, and we've seen teams that do this, and not quite to the same degree of money spending, but LA Galaxy is a perfect example of a team that really has lost their way with that. If you don't invest in that back line in many different ways, you can have a great season. You can score a lot of goals. You can win a lot of games. But LAFC, another example of a team that they tried. They had it a lot figured out until their captain left. It's just such a crucial thing. And as much as teams aren't looking at it, I feel like the smart ones are, and they know and they get it, that it's a area of the park that if you pay attention to that, other teams haven't all jumped onto that bandwagon. And you can have a lot of success just by shutting the back gates and giving your midfielders a chance to roam.
When you look at the when you look at the league, the season as a whole, a lot of people are going to bring up the seismic impact that the arrival of Wayne Rooney and Zlatan Ibrahimovic brought to the league. However, neither of them are here.
Yeah.
And that focus in terms of this is, we're going to let some people chase this model of building a team. We have our own strategy. Seems to really benefit people as you brought teams as you noted.
Absolutely, and there's two teams. I mean, LA has a lot more work to do than DC, I think. But if there's an area for DC to improve in, it's focusing a little bit more on that defensive bit. You know, they also had basically three goalkeepers this season vying for the position. I'm assuming they'll probably stick with Bill Hamid. I don't know if Osted, and then is it Clark is the other goalkeeper, I think? Steve Clark?
That sounds right. That sounds right.
Man, yeah, he was, I never thought I'd reach a point where I was so familiar with the third string DC United goalkeeper, but here we are. That, you know, maybe making some more decisions about that, for me, that would be the priority. And I mean, this is also most of the time I'm a defender, so I'm always on the side of the back four.
Well, I'm just double checking here. Kansas City also reported their switches. Nobody that you saw in the starting lineup is leaving yet.
Hmm.
It looks like no. Kyrie Shelton is the only one who's out of contract.
I'd say that was surprising, but he had sort of flashes and moments this season, but I remember there being a number of question marks about his production rate. So
the article I love compared to all the other articles on MLSsoccer.com about it notes that Sporting Kansas City has extended a bona fide offer to Shelton.
Bona fide.
I guess way more serious than all these just offers that the other teams are extending to the Mariners.
That's coming in a briefcase for sure.
Oh yeah, no doubt. The notable name here is Brad Evans, who was not featured, is eligible for free agency and has not had his contract picked up. So so that MLS veteran is on his way.
Interesting.
So they're another team where they got a lot right. They got a lot of they're keeping a lot of their key players, but they just have to figure out, you know, sort of where to go from here.
Yeah, and ultimately, I don't think they need to worry too much.
So this is what are some of the other things that have popped up? Columbus. Columbus manager Greg Berhalter, after you know incredibly poorly kept secret, officially announced for the U.S. men's national team. What does this mean for Columbus?
Yeah, it's funny because I was thinking that too, because everyone's talking about what this means for the U.S. men's national team. A bit of mixed reviews, but I think mostly positive things. Whatever, I don't want to talk about the national team in America. I'm
Yes.
similarly more interested in what it means for Columbus. I think it means big things because I think they need somebody that can come in and keep some of the consistency. Columbus has built such a good, solid thing that's built around such good, solid, simple football that's seen them through some really rough patches. They've also built something incredibly special in just what the club has been able to do to keep themselves a club and keep it in Columbus. So, ultimately, I think they're looking for somebody to come in and maintain some continuity, but also hopefully take them to the next level that they, I think, have gotten about as far as they could under Berhalter. I think it's a good time for a shift, but it's certainly, as if I was a Columbus fan, I'd be worried about like what are the ambitions here? Because just somebody that's going to come in and stay the course and kind of continue doing more of the same, although that might seem like the best idea, you need somebody to also come in and with a very clear idea of what it's going to take Columbus to the next level because they have the opportunity. Like now is the time. The next 2, 3 years, I think, should really be a changing of the guard, a shift for Columbus into the next gear and be a team that really, really makes it even more difficult to play against them because they have been that team at times, but they've also had chances sort of wasting. And I think there's a couple of other pieces that they need to add there, but the team itself is in pretty good shape. I think it really comes down to an ambitious new manager and a fantastic coaching staff. It's got to be an upgrade from what they have now, and that's a pretty tall order.
One question that I have is now that the team is going to be, I guess, switching hands, in through this expansion period, is when Precourt stops running Columbus? Like, when does Precourt Sports Ventures or whatever transfer it to whoever the next one is? Because I think that's a weird, that's a weird competitive thing now that they've sort of cut this deal to keep them there, is that that group is running a team that will be their immediate competitors very soon. Or not even very soon, because we don't even know what the timing is in terms of when, or I can't remember off the top of my head what the timing is in terms of when Austin is supposedly going to be coming into the league as an expansion team. But that's one thing that you think of in terms of who they invest in. I'm looking sort of at the coach carousel. LA Galaxy is, I believe, still in the market because they've got their interim manager out. Jesse Marsh, or sorry, not Jesse Marsh. What am I thinking?
He's definitely out. I don't think he's coming back, man.
Caleb, if you look at in the last year, managers that went places and I don't think went anywhere after this, Caleb Porter, I think, is still free, or is he working for the men's net, or the is
No,
he working for the
I believe he's still free.
Caleb Porter would be a great pick. I don't know that I was not around for the era of Siggy Schmidt, so I don't know that Siggy Schmidt's a great pick. They could do worse than Carl Robinson. But
Fine
he wants a
lines.
new and Jason Kreis is I believe still out there
Oh
and
yeah. Jason
looking
Kreis
for a
is a weird one. I can't quite pin him down. Sometimes I think he's a mad genius, and other times I think he's just mad. But no, I see our good old buddy Robbo going to a Colorado or something, or maybe a USL division. I think he could have a lot of success with a side that needs some rebuilding. I don't know that he's quite the kind of coach that can come in and build an identity and really a contending team, but certainly is a hey, everything's terrible. Like, I mean, Carl Robinson in Orlando, I think, would be a good start to just be like, let's play some basic, simple football, because apparently Orlando struggles with that greatly, of just being like, oh, wait, am I supposed to pass to my teammates? still one of the most frustrating things this season, and maybe this is a segue into MLS awards. Most frustrating thing of all this season was to watch Sasha Kljestan completely wasted on a team that is so bad.
Yeah, that was, I mean, you can't, to a certain extent, you can't just say, like, it's only Kljestan's, or, you know, Kljestan has no, Kljestan's a part of the team. And,
yep.
You know,
totally.
And it didn't have that going. But, what is, oh, I had the page up with the awards. Yeah, the awards roll through the course of the week. They started doing awards when, We kind of have been like 50-50 on it.
4 weeks ago or something?
4 weeks ago. We haven't caught up with them every single week. But pretty much all of them except the Fair Play Awards and MVP, which we're recording this on a Tuesday. It's apparently scheduled for Wednesday in Atlanta. So I think that tells you who it's probably going to be. In terms of, you know, Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
Or Almiron, but probably Martinez. Let me read you some names here. Defender of the Year, Aaron Long.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to argue that. I would say Eiko Parra would be a close second for me. But, I mean, all the people that made the short list, Walker Zimmerman, I think it would be unfair to not consider Simon. But, I mean, yeah, Aaron Long, I'm fine with that.
Goalkeeper of the Year, Zach Steffen.
100% okay with that.
He's been great. He was great the whole year. I think we did mention this. Tata Martino, Atlanta United Coach of the Year.
For what?
They're only in the finals.
Was he done for us lately?
This is really funny. Unless it is a different player. No, maybe I'm right. Rookie of the Year, Corey Baird from RSL. And because it's sometimes hard to tell who's a rookie and who's a newcomer or what in this league.
Yeah, he's a rookie. He's 27.
I'll read you the names, and I'll admit, a lot of these names are not ringing a bell. Baird had 40% of the vote. With Chris Miller from Orlando, Mark McKenzie from Philadelphia, Joao Moutinho from LA, and Alex Roldan from Seattle being the rest of the list. I don't think that it's that Joao Moutinho. I think it's a different one. There are two.
Yeah. I'm very happy with it. I think Baird is a great pick, regardless. I think he had a fantastic season. He's been an amazing bright spot for RSL. They missed him. I think their playoff run could have had a little bit more with him involved for more of the games. A great pick.
Newcomer of the Year, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, LA Galaxy.
He's the short French gentleman that joined the league. I can't quite recall. If only there was a newspaper ad that told me more.
You know, this is an award. This is an award sort of that is a seems like a huge softy every year, but I'm actually going to engage with it a little and say I don't know how you argue this over Wayne Rooney.
I don't either. I think it's called placing your lips on someone's bottom and hoping to God they'll stay because they brought in you so much tremendous amounts of cash.
That is true.
Wayne Rooney, far and away. Yes, we're on the Rooney bus now, but how do you like? Okay, Zlatan, yes, scored more beautiful goals. But there were four of them. Wayne Rooney, better all-around player, major impact for his team. His team actually did go to MLS playoffs. You know, Zlatan is a soccer god, I will say it. Best newcomer of the year? No.
If you were so inclined to, if you were so inclined, you could say that Ibrahimovic had more of an individual season, whereas Rooney
for the last 16 years of his life.
Whereas Rooney was a success in his team, but perhaps you could argue that it's, you know, that it's less up to it's less up to him that he was a success. But I would never hold the fact that somebody worked as a good teammate against them.
No, and in an era though where people are stats obsessed, and you have the nerds come out with I say that somewhat lovingly, but you got to have some way of approaching the game. But whatever. It's supposed to be the beautiful game, and I like to think that class, finesse, and it's not just the ego thing with Ibrahimovic, because I really can forgive that. I mean, he's an MLS, for God's sakes. Like, let the man just perform and be a gladiator. That's totally fine. Wayne Rooney had a better season. Just gonna say it. Disagree if you like, but stats aren't everything, and overall the impact on the team, which really should matter. I mean, that was nothing short of miraculous. So that's my 2 cents.
Gyasi Zardes is comeback player of the year.
Yeah, that's very hard to argue with that one.
Yeah, no, he had a terrible year last year. He had a pretty good one this year.
Wait, is that what a comeback is?
I guess.
Does it say who the finalists were for that? Because I'd just be curious.
I guess it's true, right? Because it's like, who's in the comeback player division?
Yeah, not because I disagree with the choice. I'm just curious of like what other players made the cut.
I remember the year that it was Dempsey because he had like a heart failure, and that was also hard to argue.
Yeah. Okay. That one's legit. We were like, I mean, really? But yes, absolutely.
Okay. So the name, so Zardes got 36%. A player got 26%. And I'm going to let you guess.
A player?
I'm gonna.
If it's Ibrahimovic, I'm leaving right now.
It's Zlatan.
This episode is over. I'm out. That's it. I'm done. Who comes up?
did you literally break it? Through your Zlatan unhappiness?
I threw my headphones on my desk to create an impact because it was near the microphone. I didn't do it that hard. I just wanted it to sound cool. And I hit the TV remote from my display and it switched the input. And I was like, oh, I've broke it.
Okay, I'm rolling again. Real time.
All right, so the breakdown on that was, from players... Players gave 24.85% of the vote to Zardes. Clubs gave 30.69%. Media gave 52.73%.
What's he coming back from? Space?
No, this is from Zardes. This is for Zardes. Zardes.
Oh, okay. All right.
Media is 52%. Media says 52% Zardes. Players, 31.87% Zlatan. More Zlatan than Zardes. Clubs, exactly the same. 30.69, and media vote 16.67. So,
okay.
So well, the media vote for Zardes was 52%, and media for Zlatan said 16%. So nobody who watches the league can figure out what the mentality was either.
I feel like being sick.
The
comeback player.
The other three players
came back
are...
from PSG.
The other three players are Ozzy Alonso, Georgi Mihailovic, and Jonathan Osorio.
Yeah, I mean, those make a little bit more sense. Osorio, for sure. Oh,
but Zlatan!
I feel like I just drank Buckley's. Like, that's the taste I have in my mouth. Oh, don't ever do that to me again. I hate this. Best comeback? No. That's like next year, Lionel Messi getting best comeback player of the year because he scores 2 more goals than this year. he had a bit of a dip. He only scored 37 instead of 59.
Join us tomorrow for League MVP Julian Gressel. or they're going to hold the MVP ceremony in Atlanta and it will be Zlatan.
That's true. It'll just come right in. And people would love it. They'd love it. Not the media, though, apparently. Oh.
The Golden Boot is Martinez, who scored a record 31.
I didn't realize just how high up in world standings he was with that, too. That I think he's like 6th or 7th across all leagues.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I saw a little graph today that he's not in all competitions, but in league play, he's actually above Messi.
Oh, really?
Different number of games, I believe, but...
Everything else is kind of a wash. Humanitarian, Matt Lampson from Minnesota. Alan sure. Kelly is the referee of the year. Joe Fletcher is the assistant referee of the year. Goal of the year is Zlatan. You know the one.
I don't like life anymore. I'm okay with that one. There were better goals, but I'm fine. As a piggy bank for MLS and as a thing that made people pay attention, sure, I'm okay with it. There were better goals.
And save of the year was Seattle Stephen Fry for his sprawling glove save while running almost backwards against Colorado on the 4th of July.
Oh, I actually do remember that one. That's fair. I'm glad Zach Steffen got his dues.
Or no, that's Stephen Fry.
Oh. Different well, Stephen. Then I'm misremembering, and I don't like it again.
Your brain just edited a highlight reel save together for you.
That's a Vancouver Whitecaps fan for you. Like, what? Seattle Sounder? No, I'm replacing it with Zach Steffen. Great save he made.
Oh, the best 11 is Steffen, Kamara Lawrence, Aaron Long, Chad Marshall, Luciano Acosta, Miguel Amaran, Ignacio Piatti, and Carlos Vela. Ibrahimovic, Martinez, and Rooney.
Yeah.
8 out of 10.
Eight out of 11, I guess. 9 out of 11.
And what a fitting way to end the episode. Unless you have anything else, in a time of year that really feels like you're every week you have to go to the cruise ship dock to wave another player off as they go on to their next journey or to the airport, depending on your metaphor. David Villa will be leaving to Japan to go play at Vissel Kobe with Iniesta.
And God bless him. Good for him. Villa's been such an incredible player, and oddly, I don't think has properly gotten his due, partly from me. Not that I think that'll hurt him any. But hopefully signaled something for New York City FC of what can happen. And it can't be overstated what he did for that team. Fantastic contributions, definitely time to move on. Definitely time for New York to think differently about how they set up their team, maybe play on a real pitch or something, but, always got to get that in there each episode. Best of luck to him. I did not know Iniesta was still playing anywhere, and it just pleases me to no end. It's like two old horses being taken out to pasture. That's super disrespectful to the J-League, but you know what I'm trying to say. Like,
yes,
it's not a particularly well-known international league where I think they will do incredibly well, and I genuinely love seeing players stay in the game regardless of where it is. They love it, so and they're those are two of the best players of our lifetime. So to have them back together again, I think is awesome.
Goodbye. Goodbye, David. We will always remember yelling at you at BC Place. If David wants to sign your yearbook or get in touch with you, where can he find you online?
He can find me online on Twitter and Instagram at That's So MLS. Where can he find you?
Are you tearing up? Are you tearing up for this emotional parting?
No, I was trying not to burp in the final seconds of the show.
And I totally blew your cover!
Oh, the beautiful game.
You can find me at Team Bates on Twitter, www.team-bates.com. I am an editor at Howler Magazine, whatahowler.com. Look for my name in upcoming issues, which I'm super excited about.
Did you write an article about soccer?
I wrote a column about soccer. Just Google an Andrew Bates song if you're wondering what that's all about. You can find this podcast at www.thatsomeoneless.com.
And thank you also to people that actually have been rating, reviewing, and subscribing, because we say that every time, but we don't always actually look at analytics and stuff. And I looked recently and I was like, wow, we've come a really long way. People are actually listening. So thank you, honestly, to those that come on this weird charade with us. We appreciate the heck out of it. And we will keep trying to deliver such quality content as tonight to you.
In the days and nights between now and MLS Cup, don't get sent off.
Don't get your goal called off, sir.